Welcome to Diverse Voices Book Review. I'm Hopeton Hay. I'm happy to welcome back to the show Karen Cecile Davison, author of The Geography of First Kisses Stories. She is the winner of the 2022 Akasha Fiction Prize, and the novel Sibelia Drive was published by her in 2020. She's originally from New Orleans, Louisiana. She's my classmate from Benjamin Franklin High School in New Orleans, Louisiana, but now she lives in Columbus, Ohio. And Karen, welcome back to Diverse Voices Book Review. Though I do believe when you came on the show, it was called KZI Book Review. So I changed the name a couple of years ago.
Thank you for having me, Hopeton. It's always such a pleasure to talk to you.
Karen, I will tell you that this book just brought up so much nostalgia for me because so many of your stories are set in New Orleans and you're going to places I'm familiar with and doing things I'm familiar with. So for me, to some degree with some of these stories, it was like a walk down nostalgia lane. And I know that when you put this collection together, that you didn't write a collection specifically for this book, but that you're pulling all these different stories you've written over the years. So what was the process like of selecting the stories to put into The Geography of First Kisses? And did you write any original stories for the collection?
When I first started writing the stories, I didn't have a collection in mind. And strangely enough, I found that of the stories, there were a few stories that I'd written that definitely didn't go in the collection. And certainly there were stories that never came out of the drawer because they were the stories that helped me find my way as a writer. So they're going to stay in the drawer. But the stories that ended up in this book seem to have the themes of, first of all, subjects of women and girls mostly. There are 14 stories, and 11 of them are told from the perspectives of women or girls between the ages of 6 and, you know, on into, when I think about it, I think the oldest character whose viewpoint we're in is probably in her 30s. So from childhood to the point where you've become a mother, perhaps. And then there were 3 stories out of the 14 that were told from male perspectives, but they were always sort of in honor of the women who were also in the stories. So this was going on, but there was also this theme of longing, searching, looking for love, looking for ways to get out of trouble, but only finding yourself more entangled within the trouble that you're trying to escape, or just trying to navigate through the situations that have the trouble with a capital T, sort of the way that that's centered around the situations. So in terms of, did I choose these stories specifically to be a collection in the first place? No, I was just sort of making my way and trying to figure out, you know, what was it like to be a writer? What was it like to create this as a livelihood? And was it going to really work? And some of these stories took 10 years to finalize. And the deeper that I went into them, the more I appreciated the characters and the more the characters changed. Bob White, the very last story, is a good example. That one, when I started it to when I finished it, it was 10 years. It was kind of crazy. I put it away. I thought it was never going to be published. And then that is one of my prouder publications. It went to Five Points Magazine, which is a wonderful literary review. And there were a couple of other ones in there.
Well, let's talk about Bob White, because that story was heartbreaking. And it It was set around Dwight Eisenhower and the way she was comparing Dwight Eisenhower going to the hospital with the point of view is a 9-year-old girl who lives in New Orleans. Her mother's has a debilitating illness. She's in the hospital and her father has sent her to live or sending her to live with her aunt and uncle in Picayune, Mississippi. And so I thought I was curious about that setting, because most of your settings are not set that far back in time. The stories, this was set during the Dwight Eisenhower in the 1950s during his presidential administration. So let's start off with the desire to set something that far back. Had you written any stories that far back before?
There were some, I'm trying to remember. In Sibelia Drive, I think I went as far back as the early to mid 60s. But not as far back as was right around mid-50s, 1955 or so, that Bob White is set. There was something about it's funny, when I think back on it, it just felt right to set it that far back, to make life simpler. You know, when rotary phones were in use, and there was the old Frigidaire freezer on the porch. And
but I have to interrupt you to let the audience know that you weren't alive in the 1950s. Yeah,
well, I was born in 1959, but I was definitely not alive in 55.
You weren't alive when the story was set, right?
So there was definitely some research in there, and there was definitely, it started out with research on shotguns because there is hunting in the story. There's quail hunting. So it started out with looking at issues and they were some of the first issues of Garden and Gun when it first came out, this kind of crazy magazine.
Wait, I never heard of Garden and Gun.
Garden and Gun is, I mean, it's just sort of an insane name for a magazine. And I learned a lot about shotguns, which is important for bringing fact into fiction to make it feel more grounded and more real. And I think that in terms of setting it in 1955, when Dwight Eisenhower was president, there's also this idea of things were perhaps more conservative in the United States. There was like a strain of conservatism versus progressivism that we were leaning hard to. And I kind of wanted to get that in terms of what kind of family this little girl was sent to in Mississippi. They go to church, they work the farm, they go out quail hunting, their life is simple. The father works at a newspaper. So there is, you know, a little bit of the intellectual in there too, but, and her father is a lawyer back in New Orleans. And it also had to do with children weren't allowed are still not allowed in many ways in the hospital with the sick in the 50s, in the way that they would be in contemporary times. Like if somebody is in the hospital in 1955 with a terminal illness, it's going to be few and far between when a daughter or a son, whoever is allowed to be in the room with them.
But the other thing that struck me about the story was a couple of other things. One was you point out going from the city and the rhythm of the city to Picayune, Mississippi, and the rhythm of living the country life. And so you point that out in the story. And her really precious relationship with her cousin who does the hunting, he begins to show her things. Sort of this blossoming of this relationship with their first cousin through the hunting and sharing the birds. And then her sort of, she's conflicted about the birds because she's thinking, oh, the birds really need to live, but they go quail hunting. And for the audience, Bob White is a type of quail, right?
Exactly.
Is a type of quail. So I thought that story was just putting us in the mind of a young 9-year-old mind with all this having to adjust to this different type of life
right
as her mother's dying. and how they've embraced her, but she's still alone and she's having to change how she fits in. And it was just such a touching story.
Thank you. I got some pushback about it earlier on that it was too sentimental.
From the
I
publisher, from your
decided
editor? Who pushed back? Who pushed back?
I was applying for grants, and that was one of the pieces that I used as it says sample writing.
Yes.
And the judges made it clear that the two pieces of stories that I had used as writing samples were too sentimental. And then I laughed about 3 months later because both of the stories were accepted for publication, thanks to my amazing agent who was able to send them in to reviews where they don't take submissions straight from the author. They have to be agent submissions. So that made that possible for me. And they were both incredible magazines or literary reviews that accepted them. So I felt that I had held out for a good reason. I trusted that those stories were finished and that they weren't too sentimental, that they were honest. And it is hard to write, it's very difficult to write from a child's perspective, especially for 20 plus pages. But I've been doing it for a while, so I feel pretty adept at it. It's funny, earlier I was listening to an interview or an article from The New Yorker that was written by Leslie Jameson about a while ago about imposter syndrome. And it's true that sometimes there is that feeling. But I was listening to it and thinking, I don't really feel that way anymore. I had my doubts earlier, and sometimes it it ebbs and flows, that sort of feeling. But I think as a writer, you have to eventually just trust in yourself, know when the story is finished, even if you get pushback. I got a lot of pushback for Sibelia Drive in terms of the many different perspectives. And I just felt like, no, this is my vision. I'm going to stick to it. And it worked out in the end. I mean, Braddock Avenue Books is an amazing small press that published it. And I'm very thankful to them for doing such a beautiful job. And then also with this book, which is a totally different press, which is based in Austin, and ironically, the same, it's a very different cover, but it's the same artist as for Sibelia Drive. So there's a lot of creative freedom in working with small presses. And they just work so hard to make it to work with, I mean, the author has to work in collaboration with the small press to end up with the product that people are going to buy, which is kind of crazy because it's this like whole creative process, which then goes into this package, and you want it to be right. You want it to be beautiful, so that somebody can enjoy it and have it and read the stories and have it on their shelf and maybe pick it up two or three more times or pass it on to a friend or, just in terms of this collection and these stories. I hope that there's a lot of universe. I feel that there's a lot of universal themes that others can relate to. And so that's what I hope for readers when they pick up the book is that they'll feel that, oh, there's somebody else out in the world like me, and here's this person in the story that I can relate to. It's like I feel that way too sometimes.
Well, I think a lot of people can relate to First Kisses, the geography of First Kisses.
With that, the story with the first kiss in it.
Yeah, I don't think there's any doubt about that. And I think sentimentality, while you're is something that a lot of us can relate to, though I will say that because you brought out some things that we did at Benjamin Franklin High School. Word Power Made Easy. I remember us having to read Word Power Made Easy. Mr. Fernandez. I took a class from Mr. Fernandez. Mrs. Newman. Is it Newman?
Yeah, she's. I changed all the names.
But you had teachers in there. I took classes
together.
I was wondering as I read through that these stories, especially Geography of First Kisses, and the stories of going to different places, going crabbing and these other things. How much of it is based on your experiences, and how do you take your experiences growing up, those you've had personally, and sort of mix it in with your imagination to create some of these stories?
There's a lot of fact that goes into the fiction because, of course, you want to, the settings for the most part are real, except for Dynamo, Iowa, in the story Sweet Iowa. But for example, in one night, one afternoon, sooner or later, that's based on real experiences of going crabbing in Bagosh and other bayous in Louisiana that aren't too far from New Orleans. You have to drive a little bit, but not too far.
Now, I'm not talking about the settings as much, because we understand when you're writing the stories, these settings are going to be real.
Right.
The relationships, the things that happen between the people. And I know, I remember once I interviewed an author, and his book was about a Harvard basketball player that worked on Crimson Magazine and some of the issues he had. And the author told me in the interview, well, no, this is not based on my life. Well, the author played basketball for Harvard and worked on the magazine. So I said, you're telling me, well, I didn't say this. I was thinking, you're telling me that it's not based on your life, but the parallel between the character's life and your life are eerily close. Mm-hmm. Now, I know most authors don't do that, but there is often I hear someone had an experience. Attica Locke from Houston, her story, her first novel, Blackwater Rising, starts off set at a bayou in Houston, and somebody is screaming for help, and this young lawyer with his pregnant wife is on a boat, and he hears somebody screaming for help. Well, Attica told me, well, actually, that happened to, I was out on the boat with my dad and his wife, and this actually happened. Except, of course, she changed the circumstances, because in real life, he didn't respond to it, but in the novel, she actually had the character respond to it. So I was just wondering, not from the settings, but
right,
you find your personal life and your personal experiences, but broadly speaking, for some of these stories.
Well, I can give you a few examples. The seed of Bob White was the scene where Robbie is cleaning the quail. So Robbie was the actual name of a teenage boy who was a friend of my mother's brother, younger brother, much younger brother, the baby of the family. And he was probably 15 years younger than my mother's friend, his sister. And we were out at their farm, at their country place in Picayune, Mississippi, for a picnic. And it was a day-long event with a pig roast, and you go swimming in the pond and all of that. Lie in the hammock. And then at the end of the day, the men come back and they've been hunting quail. And Robbie called me over. I was the only other kid. Robbie called me over, and I think I was 8 or 9. So right around the same age as Carly and the character in the story. And I remember as a child, I was always fascinated. This is going to sound really strange, but I was on the edge in college of becoming a chef. And this is because of these things that I had all of these interests in cooking and in what it would be like to be in a kitchen as a line cook or, you know, and I certainly worked in kitchens in New Orleans. I worked in restaurant kitchens, but previous to that, as a child, I was fascinated with standing on a stool, looking into the sink, watching my grandmother or whoever wash a chicken and prep it to roast in the oven. Or with Robbie in that situation, watch him dress the quail, watch him behead the little birds and take out the innards and all that. And, which many people would not, many kids would not be fascinated with that. So perhaps I was a little strange, but it all made sense in the end, considering how much I love to cook and how I wanted to sort of pay homage to those sweet little quail who had done such a good job. And then,
So you were empathetic toward the quail.
yeah, there was, there's the quail who's beautiful when it's alive, and then also in death, a lovely meal.
Let me tell you about the story that I was really shocked with the ending. I shouldn't say shocked, but very surprised. I'll just say the biker and the girl.
Oh yeah, everybody's
Yes. So the waitress and the welders, he has wanderlust. She's lives with her father. The mother, I believe, left. I thought that was I didn't see it coming.
It was a surprise for me too. And it's not, to me, the ending is open, that it's not clear what happens next.
I know, but let's just say the ending makes you wonder deeply what happens next. You're just surprised in the reading the story that it got to that point because you said, we're going down the path, we're going down the path, we're going, oh, well, we're gonna surprise you with this. And it made sense for the story, right? He's this wanderlust type of character who motorcycles traveled all over the place. He's trying to settle down now, meets a girl, meets a waitress. She's only 17. How old is the gentleman and the biker and the girl? Because she's only 17.
I have him in my mind as in his 30s, so twice her age.
Oh, I was afraid of that. That's, yeah, wow.
So yeah, that one is, there are a couple of dark stories in this collection, and that is definitely one of them. There was some pushback on that ending from the editor who helped me take the stories as they were when they won the Acacia Fiction Prize. And the editor, this editor was is from Texas. She's from, no, wait, I take that back. She lives in Texas now, but she is actually from West Louisiana. So Prairie, in that part of Louisiana, that's Prairie. And there were so many different things she caught that were just little tiny like typo mistakes because of a misspelling. Like at one point, Lake Pontchartrain was missing that P-O-N-T. It was misspelled as P-O-N Chartrain. And she also caught some things about in the Great Wide that had to do with Catholicism. There were certain words that need to be capitalized and certain words that needed a feminine ending. So she also knew French. And she was quite the gem. But that story for her, the biker and the girl, the ending was too dark. She could not believe that the biker would do that in terms of the fact that he was trying to settle down. And I said, yeah, I can see where you're going, but I feel strongly that the ending needs to remain the same. And there were some slight little tweaks to that story, but for the most part, it stayed as it was. And that was the first story I ever published. And it was under a different name. They did not like the name, The Biker and the Girl, but I decided in the collection take back the what they call the generic title, because I wanted these two characters to not have names. I just wanted them to be the biker and the girl and stand that way, even though I feel like they're very strong characters, and they do, through their non-names, they are named, if that makes any sense.
Yes.
So, yeah.
So let me tell you, my favorite story was We Are Here Because of a Horse.
Oh.
And it was my favorite story because I felt so much for Melly. Is that how you pronounce it?
Melly.
It was Melly and Sam, 22 and 21. And that whole backstory of her escaping from her family and getting to Sam's house and saying, I'm going to stay here. And his mother says, okay. And her, I don't want to use the word obsession, but it's almost like this magical horse. It's almost like a little bit of magical realism with this, the horse that she says she's chasing when she climbs into Sam's house at the age of 12, I think, when she ran away from her family.
Yeah, she's a little younger at that point.
And then they're going to pick up a horse that they're not sure that they paid for, that they're not sure that is really there. And that story to me, that story was magical to me, actually.
Yeah, there's definitely a fabulous strain to the story that is, there were questions when in the process of writing from a writing group that stayed together. I was in grad school at Lesley University, and we had a very strong class, and there were about 12 of us that really wanted to stay in contact and share writing, exchange responses about our stories. And that group said, is the horse real, or is the horse a metaphor?
That's the beauty of the story, that we don't know and we're right. Wondering. Right. I'd love that.
Right. I think that's sort of a strain that follows through the collection, is you're not, there is, when there are stories like In the Great Wide and We're Here Because of a Horse that have these fabulous threads through them, it makes you wonder, is this real? Is this like this huge metaphor that we're working with? And I think for me, that's purposeful, to keep the interest of the reader, to bring more depth to the story and to the characters.
So I'm going to have to ask you to define, you've used the term fabulous for those. How would you define that for just a reader who loves literature, but is not familiar with that term?
So in terms of appropriation or misappropriation, I was always told that that when I'm working with a story like In the Great Wide, where not to give it away, but there is a strange baby in it, for those readers who don't want to be surprised, or in We Are Here Because of a Horse, where is the horse real, or is the horse metaphor, that rather than think of this kind of writing from me as magical realism, to think of it, because I'm not part of that school, I'm not Garcia Marquez or any of the original magical realist writers, but in terms of like Amy Bender or Kelly Link, women who were writing specifically stories that have this surreal, magical, weird element, where where the first thing you see when you enter, this is from an Amy Bender story, is a little tiny man in a birdcage. And you're very worried about this little tiny man in the birdcage, because why is he so tiny? And why is he in a birdcage? You know, so you're immediately like, boom, in the story because of these strange elements. So that has been named, labeled fabulism for the most part, in my, as far as I understand. So these surrealist elements that create these wild off the wall stories, they're going in a much more exaggerated direction than I am, perhaps, except for with the baby in The Great Wide, maybe. But and then magical realism has, it's, I don't know, there's something more like fairy tale in there for me. Like in 100 Years of Solitude.
Right.
Crazy. Within the first 20 pages, all of these things.
But sort of overwhelming and dominates the story. One of my favorite writers writing about the Mexico, Texas history, he starts off with this ghost, and this ghost is constantly around you. Like, okay, I get that. But for you, you give us, it's a whisper. It's a touch. It's not overwhelming. It's a whisper. It's a touch.
That's nice.
But that makes it so much more attractive to just have that touch, just that slight wonder, as opposed to overwhelming us with constant references to the horse that makes us wonder where it's here. Is it real? Is it not? But you just give us a nice touch of it.
I love that. I love to hear that that's how it comes across.
I got to ask you, are you a big fan of movie director Gus Van Sant Jr.? Who, for those who may not know, is probably best known for directing Good Will Hunting, which won 2 Academy Awards and was written by Matt Damon and Ben Affleck. And Matt Damon and Ben Affleck, along with Robin Williams, starred in that movie. But there's one of your character teaches film and also is a bartender. And once again, we get some Gus Van Sant. So is that fabulous? At some point?
I think that's a whisper of fabulism.
A whisper, sure. Yes.
Is it her imagination, or is he really there? This Gus Van Sant that keeps appearing and making her coffee and driving her places in his bottle green truck.
So are you a fan of Gus Van Sant?
I am.
Have you had dreams about Gus Van Sant?
No.
Can I ask you that question?
No, I do. I do really appreciate his films. And I must have been, it's funny how certain things end up in stories. I must have been watching a bunch of Gus Van Sant movies. There was a, and here's another little fact into the fiction part of the story. I did indeed briefly meet Gus Van Sant on the stairs. I was coming late to his film, and he had just spoken before the film. So doggone it, I missed that. But I did get to meet him on the stairs because he was escaping his own film and leaving to go have dinner during the film with the curator of the Wexner Film Theater at the Wexner Center is a big creative space with galleries and all kinds of the theater and auditorium and all that at the Ohio State University, for those who don't know. There was a little bit of a thrill in meeting Gus Van Sant, even if only for 10 seconds on the stairs. Oh, Karin and John, I'm so glad you're here for the movie. This is Gus. I'm like, what? But as I said, we didn't even have a conversation. It was just like a brief wave on the stairs. And I think actually the movie might even be named in the story that we saw, Mala Noche or something like that. Anyway.
Yeah, well, I saw a few of his films, and he's a very, very interesting director. I want to close with you talking about the 10 years it took you to finish one story, because new writers that I talk to who don't have a lot of experience tend to look at short stories as a few. Let me say a few of the new writers I've talked to, because I don't want to paint this broad stroke. Tend to look at short stories as an easier entry into writing than a novel. And you've done both.
I would say, well, I don't know if you have actually asked your question. I don't want to interrupt, but
10 years would shock. If I go to someone who wants to be writing and said, you could have a short story that took you 10 years to finish, they'll fall out of their chair.
yeah, so in response to that, I would say it's not that I was continuously writing the story for 10 years. I probably wrote five or six drafts in the first, I'd say, 2 months, where, and this is actually in grad school, so it was probably 2008 or so. By the time I actually finished the story, felt comfortable where I had had lots and lots of response, including and going through many, many submissions, like where I feel like the story is done. And sending it out to various literary reviews, and this is pre-agent. I didn't have an agent at that point. I didn't have an agent until 2017, so nearly 10 years later, and realizing, oh, I could do one more change to that character. There could be another paragraph making this more clear. There was a paragraph or three maybe that were added to Sweet Iowa, for example, the scene where Sam and Melly are walking with the piglet into the bar. That was very short and compressed, and I needed to slow that down. So in order to slow it down, I needed to add more about what was going on in the bar, like really make it alive. And it's from Howdy's point of view. He's one of the few male perspectives in the book. So from his, and he's an interesting character. So from his very specific perspective, what was that like to walk into a biker bar with this woman who just showed up in his, in the middle of a storm, and then they're going to do this crazy thing? And that was because of one of the I had gotten a rejection from this magazine, and I thought, I'm gonna ask the editor why he rejected it. And it was somebody that were you can't always do that with the editor of a literary review, but with this person, I thought, well, I can have a conversation with this particular person. And he said, I just felt that this character wasn't clear. And then, so I made that character, I gave that character more depth and more, I really, she is the strong woman. She's the strong, independent woman who shows up from Texas in Dynamo, Iowa. And she's like the stranger that blows into town. And then there's storms that keep happening. And she did need to be more defined. So it was a really good suggestion. And when I made her more defined, he then accepted the story. But while we were going through the edits to actually include it in the, I think it was a spring or summer edition for Story Magazine, he said, I think we need to expand here and compress there and expand here. So we did those things. So in the end, after the story had been sent, I don't even know how many, to 20 different literary reviews, and it had then morphed into something, it had become such a, it became a better story because of his suggestions and my feeling like it wasn't a pushback. It was like this opening up of this story that had sat in a drawer that didn't need to sit in a drawer. It was a good story. It should be published, but that there was so much more that could happen within the story to make it better and have it really bloom on the page. So
maybe the lesson for aspiring writers is, you know, when you're working on your stories, if you put them away or there's rejections, you may want to go back and take a look at improving those stories, try to get some feedback. And even if you put it in the drawer, don't look at it for 10 years, you may come back and say, okay, I need to make these changes. I need to make that change. That story isn't done until, I guess, it's accepted.
Right. And even then,
there may be more changes coming.
Even then, when it went into the collection, we found misspellings. Despite all the copy edits and all of that stuff, there was only one, but it was really funny. I said, oh, that was published like that in Story Magazine. Oh dear,
wow.
Forgive me.
So, Karen Cecile Davison, author of The Geography of First Kisses stories, I've really enjoyed reading this collection. I like the nostalgia, the sentimentality, the fabulism, as opposed to the magical realism. I just like just these different points of view. I just really, really enjoyed reading these stories. So thank you so much for publishing this short story collection.
Thank you, Hopeton. I want to do a shout out to something I didn't mention, the theme of strong women, strong girls and women.
Yes.
It's important, especially considering your daughter who's doing amazing things in radio and on the debate team and all of that. And also a shout out to the cover artist, Annie Russell, who I think she's at Secret Lunch on Instagram, but that's sort of how you find her if you want to look at more of her pictures. And she does ceramics, but she's amazing. And she also did the cover of my other book, Sibylla Drive. So just a little love shout for her.
Absolutely. And what's your website address?
It is KarinCecileDavidson.com. That's KarinCecileDavidson, KarinCecileDavidson.com.
Thank you so much for being a guest on Diverse Voices Book Review.
Thank you, Hopeton. Loved it.
Thank you. Thank you for listening to Diverse Voices Book Review. I'm Hopeton Hay, host and producer. The theme music is provided by Wright Productions.